Hey listeners, we're so glad to be bringing you the first series of our new season, and we hope you're enjoying the new format. Before we get started today, we wanted to take a second to thank all of our listeners and ask for a small favor. If you're enjoying the show, please head to your podcast player and leave Death by Champagne a 5-star review. Your reviews help us reach new subscribers and grow our show. If you want more Death by Champagne in your life, you can follow us at Dead From Champs on Instagram and Twitter, Death by Champagne Podcast on Facebook, or join our Patreon page at patreon.com/deathbychampagne. None of this would be possible without our listeners, so thank you. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to Death by Champagne, the podcast here to keep you up at night. This week, we continue our dive into Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer. This episode solely covers GRK victims number 2 through number 15. We pick up right where we left off with victim number 2, Deborah Lynn Bonner. We cover a lot of ground this week and touch on a few of Ridgway's dump sites, including a major site that will be further discussed in next week's episode, the Star Lake site. We end the episode in October of 1983 when Kelly Ware is discovered near the SeaTac airport. This episode contains foul language, graphic discussions about rape, murder, body sites, and decomposition. We also dip our toe into politics at the end. We'll do our best to stay on track, but the bottles are popped. Hello.
Welcome back to Death by Champagne.
I'm Olivia.
And I'm Mackenzie.
And we are on part 2 of our Green River Killer episode.
This week, we are going to move further into the murders themselves, some of his motivations, discoveries.
Yes.
Last week, we covered all of his childhood. And there are some details, definitely, like from his childhood and his past, that we will get into more.
Mm-hmm.
After
circle back,
he confesses.
Yes.
And we get that information.
I think we mentioned it last time. We don't know how many episodes this will end up being.
Yes.
But we're covering everything. So buckle up.
I'm going to bet $20 on 4 episodes.
Yeah.
Minimum 4.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see how long this one takes.
Yes.
We'll see how far we get with this episode.
Oh, I didn't tell you. Sorry to drag everyone again into Sabrina world.
Oh,
I finished it.
You did?
I didn't realize that there were only 8 episodes.
Oh, yeah.
So it just ended and I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah, there's only 8. Because they bought, I think we talked about this, they bought like 16.
Yeah.
Or they like confirmed 16. So they're breaking it up into 2 parts, like half and half.
Well, they should do more or less. It just felt kind of like... I'm going to compare it to, if anyone has read the books, like the Miss Peregrine series by Ransom Riggs, they made a movie out of mm-hmm. the first one, and it's fucking trash.
Mm.
It goes on this weird Tim Burton acid trip joyride that no one asked for. And like the books themselves are so whimsical, so imaginative, you did not need to stray from the plot whatsoever. Like it's already like fantasy, magic, shape-shifting.
Yeah.
You did not need to go where you did, and that's what the season of Sabrina felt like. Like, who are the pagans? I didn't need them. I don't care.
I agree. I don't think we needed the pagans. I feel like they just threw that in there as, like, a precursor to what's coming, because they are not the elder gods that they've been warned about. Like, that they've been warned are coming. Like, this bigger fight that they're going to have to do. So I think they were just, like, a thing to placehold while we built up everything else that was going on with Sabrina.
True.
We're not going to spoil the ending, but...
But I did feel like it was just that. A placeholder.
I mean, yeah.
I mean, the outfits were to die for.
Oh, I fucking
Aunt Zelda's everything, always.
Everything. I love Aunt Zelda.
But I did not care about the pagans.
Yeah.
I want to know who put that fucking mess on Richard Quill's head. Which, like,
I can't remember. I wish I remember what Chris said when he came on the scene, but it was something very similar to what you had said.
He had beard dreads, which I thought for a while we were going to make him some, like, weird incarnation of Jesus. Bad. And I was like, okay, I can get down with your iteration of white Jesus, whatever, because he's already such a part of the story with, like, Judas and whatever.
It was just, like, a castaway, I've been here for 15 years or whatever.
Literally castaway.
It was castaway.
Which, by the way, I did look up pictures of the actor that plays Father Blackwood, and he does have really bushy hair.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I did like all the things he got to do this season. He got to play, like, pretend that Hilda was him. Like, remember when, like, Hilda had to, like, morph into him?
Yes.
That was great. Oh. Dude, that is not a good look.
I'm showing Olivia his natural hair.
Oh, he looks so much better with that, like, slicked back. Oh, that's bad.
He did. That's his hair. His I'm big sorry, actual sir. Hair.
That's not cute.
So, like,
I mean, that's not
I think I see
bad.
Their inspiration for it.
Yeah.
But also,
how did this person walk into the casting audition and get picked for this part?
I mean, they had to have seen him with his hair slicked back because Aaron Samuels be like, you is can sexy leave. With his hair pushed back.
Yeah. Because he looks so just like doofy there, but he looks very like serious and intimidating. Like, on Sabrina.
Look at this. Look at that smile.
He looks like a doofy dad.
He does.
Who's an accountant.
He looks so
happy. And likes
to
play frisbee on the weekends.
He looks like he could be, like, I don't know. I was going to say dollar store John Krasinski, but, like, like, look at this.
Yeah. Upside down, it looked like, is his name John Hamm?
Yeah.
Yeah. Upside down, that's what it looks like. But like bad.
Anyway.
That's our Sabrina rant for the day.
Just had to update Olivia that I finished it because she's been nagging me to do so for weeks.
Yes, I have been.
Okay.
Are we ready?
I think we're ready. When we last left off in episode 1, Gary Ridgway had just gotten a divorce from his second wife and was moving into various relationships with people from the group Parents Without Partners. Now that we know more about Gary Ridgway's past, we head to an area referred to as the Strip, which was located in King County, right off the Pacific Highway South. King County is situated between two other large counties in the state of Washington, Snohomish County to the north and Pierce County to the south. It's the early 1980s, and at the time, all the towns that King County encompassed, including large cities like Seattle, ranked just over 1 million in population. By 1981, a countrywide 911 system is put into effect. That is absurd that it's that late.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, being a child of the 90s, like, we don't know,
right, I know.
What life was like without 911. Yeah. Aside from Ted Bundy making his mark in and around the state of Washington, the previous decade, King County was your average area containing small suburbs, remote land, and large cities. So the main area that we're going to focus on is the Strip, an area right off the highway where numerous motels, bars, and restaurants could easily be accessed. And being so close to the highway, it was a perfect place for Gary Ridgway to flee once he had a victim in his grasp. During this time, when Gary Ridgway was most active, it was quickly realized another serial killer had hit the state of Washington. Soon, women, primarily those in the sex work industry, were becoming more cautious, and families began wondering if their missing daughter had become a victim of the Green River Killer. Many of them would not get answers for almost 2 decades.
So in our previous episode, we covered the first victim who had been found, Wendy Caulfield, and she was found in Gary Ridgway's first dumping ground, which was the Green River, and that is how he got his name. Was because his first 5 victims would be found there. So victim number 2, and I think we haven't mentioned it, but I think it will become obvious as we go. These are in order as they were found, not in order of as they went missing.
Yes. We have a detailed list that Olivia kindly typed up.
Yes.
That maybe we should post this on Instagram.
Yeah.
That
would be good.
Organized in a way, like, it's listed in the order It's that they were found, right?
Yeah, the order that they were found. And then to the left, there are numbers that are the number that they went missing.
That they were reported missing.
Yeah, when they were found.
So then you have two different ways to, like, quantify all of this information.
Yes. So Deborah Lynn... My phone went dark. Deborah Lynn Bonner grew up in Tacoma, Washington. She was the oldest and had two younger brothers. Like most of the women we'll talk about, she dropped out of high school when she was a junior with plans to join the Navy, but she didn't pass the test and was never admitted. She struggled finding a decent job without an education and initially had plans to obtain her GED. But before this could happen, she fell in love with a piece of shit man, in my opinion. He enjoyed the money Deborah brought in more than he enjoyed her. To support the two of them, Deborah turned to sex work. She was eventually picked up by the police and arrested twice for, I mean, what it was called then, prostitution, quote unquote. After this, she accumulated $1,000 in fines and determined to pay it off and start a new life, not do that anymore. She was contributing $25 a week to eliminate her debt. And by most accounts, she was trying really hard to find work outside of the sex industry. But the last time her friends saw her was around July 18th at the Three Bears Motel, located at the corner of the Pacific Highway and 216th Street. Friends of hers knew she was out working, and she told a few that she was going to, in quotes, catch some dates. She never returned to the hotel, but she called her parents a few days after, on July 20th, to check in on her father's eye surgery. That was the last time they heard from her. Deborah's nude body would be the second to be found in the Green River, about a quarter mile away from Wendy's, just a few yards from the slaughterhouse that Frank Leonard worked at. He was the unfortunate individual who found Deborah on August 12, 1982, just about a month after Wendy's body was found. In the beginning of what investigators would soon learn were not standalone murders, but the beginning of a massive manhunt for a serial killer who would claim, at the minimum, 48 victims in the state of Washington. Deborah, like Wendy, had likely floated down the river past where she had actually been dumped and caught on something in the water. She was more easily identifiable than Wendy. Her fingerprints were already in the police database from her previous arrests. And like Wendy, she had tiny dots of paint on her body.
So, just 3 days after Deborah's body was found on August 15th, a local man was searching the Green River for antique bottles and other valuable items when he came across two figures. Almost frozen under the surface of the river, definitely not visible from the road, or possibly even if someone was just walking close to the river, but since he was actually wading in the water, he stumbled across them. He had found the bodies of 31-year-old Marcia Faye Chapman and 17-year-old Cynthia Hinds, both African-American. He immediately paddled back to the bank and ran as fast as he could to the road, where he finally flagged a car down, telling them to call the police immediately. These bodies were different than Wendy and Deborah. They were being held down under the water, with what I would say is boulder-sized rocks on their chest and stomachs. Did you see the stupid tweet from... I think it was, like, from a police department, and, like, a boulder had fallen down into the road, like, onto the highway from, like, above, and it said, a large boulder, the size of the small boulder, has fallen.
And then, like, excuse me, what?
Inappropriate, but that's all I could think of right there. What I would call a small boulder. As Detective Dave Reichert approached the water's edge, he slipped, intentionally falling backwards to avoid actually falling into the water. And he discovered a third victim on the riverbank. She was paler than the other two victims, possibly of mixed race, and appeared to be younger and sunburnt from her body being exposed. Her shorts were tied around her neck as a ligature. She would later be identified as 16-year-old Opal Mills. Opal is one of the only victims in our tale whose body had another person's DNA on her. She had semen in her vagina, and the blood type was O. Identifying victims who have been submerged in water can be extremely difficult, and a quote directly from Anne Rule, it gives a graphic and eerie picture of how this is often done. It wouldn't be easy to take their fingerprints because of skin slippage caused by long immersion in warm water and decomposition. As the body decomposes, hand and finger skin loosens so much that it can be slipped off like a glove. In order to transfer prints, pathologists sometimes have to sever the skin at the wrist and then slip their own hand into the glove and press the crinkled tips onto an inked pad. Which, I don't know. I have read so many things where this has happened that I'm desensitized to it.
Yeah.
But bless anyone who has ever had to actually do that.
Could you imagine?
Because it's so important. It has to be done.
It has to be done. Yeah.
It feels so vulgar and like profane to talk about
that. And just like violating. Like so violating.
That like I have to destroy this human body
and put
more.
My body part into
that I have to use it as a tool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's so like such an important thing that's going to help solve this case.
Yeah. Yeah.
So all three victims were strangled to death. Both Marcia and Cynthia had been raped physically and symbolically. A triangular-shaped stone was inserted into each of their vaginas. This was so tight that the stones had to be surgically removed after they were found. And as far as I found, these were the only victims that had this done to them.
Yeah.
Just.
Which makes me wonder, like, with him inserting fruit into his girlfriend's vagina, if that was, like, some way it was just, like, a, you know, maybe that was, like, the same thing with, you know, he killed a cat, then he just stabbed a kid. Then he would, like, escalate these sexual things with his partners. And then, like, this was, like, another just little escalation. But then he started doing different things or more things.
Oh, I think it's...
That is just, like, that was fine. But, like, I don't need to do that.
Well, and I mean, it's so...
I mean, it's weird.
Yeah.
It's... Very weird.
Disgusting.
Yeah.
And so violating.
Well, I mean, as we'll get into, we know he started visiting them.
Yeah.
After he stopped dumping them in the water, so...
And I think it's all... I mean, I would... love dearly someone else's explanation for this that could give more insight. But I think it is a small escalation to say, okay, I'm going to like use this as a tool to have a gratifying sexual experience with my partner, even if it means a different thing for me than it does to her.
Mm-hmm.
And then to say, even if this woman is already deceased, like it goes from being something that is like smaller and used in an okay situation with consent to I'm going to violate you. And for it to be like so tight that it had to be surgically
removed.
Yes,
that it had to
removed,
be surgically removed.
I think that is, while disturbing, the key detail. That is the escalation.
Yeah.
He intended to leave those items there.
Oof.
Marcia was very petite and often called Tiny by her friends. Like, as a nickname, not just as a descriptor.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
She was a mother of three, ages 11, 9, and 3, and her main way to support her three children was sex work. She lived on the Strip, so it was a convenient place to pick up dates. She'd left her apartment on August 1st, 1982, and that was the last time she was seen. Cynthia was nicknamed Cookie, and she was described as a vibrant, pretty 17-year-old who was also involved in sex work. It is unclear if the other girls had a pimp, but Cynthia definitely did. I think that her age attributed to her feeling extremely confident and safe in doing what she did. So, like, for being so young,
You're invincible.
Yeah, that's exactly the word I was going to use. I can just picture the attitude that, like, I have a protector.
Yeah,
I'm
especially
better off
having, a pimp, who's helping you.
Yeah.
So you think.
Yes. So her pimp told detectives after her body was identified that he had last seen her on August 11th when she got into a black Jeep with a male driver, but he didn't write down the license plate, nor could he give a detailed description of the driver.
So in episode 1, we kind of mention that, you know, some of Ann Rule's book has gotten criticism, and I think this is kind of a key point to that. Marcia and Cynthia were both black, and obviously, this is very little information when you hear some of the other victims we cover in far more detail. And we don't know, I mean, if that's because of their race or if it's because truly no one could be found to talk about them or what their lifestyle situation was, that there wasn't anyone willing to talk to police, willing to talk to reporters, whatever it may have been, to give them more information about these individuals' lives. So it is unfortunate. I've Googled all of their names to see if there's any more information now or if there's been anything else, but that has yet to be found. So just wanted to point that out, that it is shitty that we couldn't find more information on them and that we are acknowledging the fact that they are some of the few African-American victims we'll come across in this story.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's also, I don't think that many of our listeners need to hear it, but just to know that this is probably a time in history when, like, I mean, today people don't feel comfortable calling the police.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah.
So why would you?
Right.
Or why would you rely?
Any of her friends may also be in sex work.
Right.
So why would they
reach out? No one's going to cooperate or help
when
they don't think that it's going to be worth anything.
Yes.
Or that it could get them or another loved one into trouble.
Yes.
It's just so easy to see why no one wanted to come forward or help if that is part of the reason why there is so little information.
Definitely. So Opal, our third victim found that day, her family identified her remains at the King County Medical Examiner's Office after artist sketches were released with a detailed description of what the fifth victim found in the Green River looked like. Opal wasn't like the rest of Gary's victims thus far. Accounts from her closest friends and brother, Opal wasn't a sex worker. She came from a loving home, for the most part, with an older brother. The last time her mother, Kathy, saw her was 3 days before her body was found. She had left home that day to go paint houses with her friend Cookie, the same Cookie that was found in the water next to her. So, Opal's story, there is a lot. Like, I didn't even touch. I summarized, very much summarized. But if anyone is interested, I mean, her mother wrote a book, which I mentioned. Yeah, her mother wrote a book called Through a Mother's Eyes, and there's a lot in Anne Rule's book about Opal and her family, which I don't know if that's, like, from her mom's book. Like, if what's in Anne Rule's book is also similar to what is in her mom's book or what, but...
I'm sure if it was already available, then she used it as a source.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that her family was more open to talking since they were already in the process of getting her story out there.
Yes. So Opal's family ended up in the state of Washington because her parents were in a biracial relationship. Her mother was white and from Missouri, and her father was black. And it wasn't legal at the time in most states for couples of different races to marry, which is absurd.
I was so...
so shocked. I mean, this wasn't the 80s when this happened, but, like, still, at the 60s...
One, like,
right?
I know, we know that.
Maybe even the 70s, like, but that. What the fuck?
But to see that written on paper,
it's Yeah.
Unbelievable.
There were only 15 states at the time with no miscegenation laws.
Miscegenation.
And Washington was one of them. So they moved to Washington and slowly cut ties with Kathy's racist relatives back home. Opal's older brother, Garrett, remembers when Opal was born, calling her the princess of the family and remembering that from the time she was born, my main job always was to look after Opal and keep her safe. So from the outside, their family life was pristine and perfect as Opal and Garrett grew up, but inside was a very different story. Their father was filled with rage and their mother had no control over what he may have said or did to them. Garrett remembers growing up with tough love from his dad, but he never felt he was neglected or abused. At the age of 16, though, Garrett moved out, unable to handle his father's outbursts. Opal dropped out of high school at 15 and was trying to obtain her GED. Mostly, they were just kids trying to figure it out. Opal was dating a few guys. Garrett recalls her being a little boy crazy, but nothing really serious. The last day he spent with her, he said they just goofed off. They went to a place for hamburgers, walked around, stole a grocery cart, jumped in it and rode down the hill. He said he felt like they were 8 years old again. And I mean, I'm pointing all this out because the media at the time, just like, obviously it's not okay regardless, but they just threw around the word prostitute, not sex worker, but sex worker for all of the victims. And just, and that alone just made it like no one cared. And like, Opal was not, from all accounts that we can find, a sex worker, and she was just, like, thrown into that mix. Not that it matters whether she was or not, but it just, like...
Right.
But at the time, it was like, well, she was a sex worker, too, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But it's like, no, she wasn't, and even if she was, it does matter, but, like, she wasn't.
Well, right, for victimology purposes, it does matter, because who are you looking at?
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
are these people yes. being taken yes. from? Where are these women... Yes. Like, you know, yes. where are they spending these vulnerable moments where they're being murdered?
Right.
What's the right. connection? You need to know that. And, like, not to be an apologist for them not defining that sooner.
Yeah.
But it's just such a detail that, like, I mean, no one can say if it would have advanced the case further or not. Right. I can say that early, I don't think it really would have.
No.
But it's just an important thing, posthumously, after the fact, to say, like,
yes,
every person's individual situation would be key to the investigation.
Agreed.
The following day, after Opal, Cynthia, and Marcia were found on August 16th, 1982, the Green River Task Force was formed by Major Dick Kraske, who was the commander of the Major Crimes Unit, who also worked the Ted Bundy case. I am also saying his last name is Kraske because I feel like someone else said it that way once and I remember it for some reason. I literally can find no news interviews or like TV spots where someone says his name out loud.
She just spent like 5 minutes searching the internet and there's literally nothing.
You try typing the name Dick into YouTube. Sorry. There's literally no hope. Sorry, if your name's Dick, you can't get anything to come up other than weird videos about cops thinking that your dick is a weapon, which is like clearly a prank show.
Ew.
And I'm like, no, I hate everything you're doing. The task force included 25 investigators from King County, Seattle PD, Tacoma PD, and Kent PD. At this time, it was uncertain how many killers they were looking for. In their eyes, it would have been much easier to haul 5 bodies down to the river without being seen if you had an accomplice. It was also noted that the killer or killers had to be in the area, probably having watched the news when the first 2 victims, Wendy and Deborah, were found near the river. And then he got smarter and added heavy boulders to weigh the other 3 victims down. In the early days, they met in the same King County courthouse where the Ted Bundy task force met, and it was a tiny, cramped room, but far enough into the courthouse that no one would be able to get in without being stopped if they weren't actually involved in the Green River investigation.
So, as we move farther into our story, you will notice that once one of Gary Ridgway's dumping grounds is discovered, he doesn't go back. And as the task force is formed and bodies are being found that could possibly be linked to the Green River, this happens pretty frequently. Like, once the ball starts rolling and we find one body somewhere, multiple bodies are discovered there. And then he moves on and starts dumping them elsewhere. Gary liked the outdoors, especially the woods. We'll learn a little later that his entire bedroom was wallpapered with fucking forest wallpaper.
That reminds me of one of my grandmother's boyfriends.
Oh, God.
That we spent time with when I was a child. I mean, I have a lot of, like, surprisingly, I have a lot of memories with him. This particular boyfriend, he had a motorcycle. And I remember running in the house and telling my mom, like, I'm going to go on a ride. His name was Oral.
Oh, God.
I was like, I'm going to get on Oral's motorcycle. And she was like, absolutely not, get back in the house. And they took me to the circus once.
Oh, nice.
But he had that wallpaper. Oh, he had a spare bedroom.
Like, everywhere or just, like, one wall?
He had, like, a spare bedroom that was, like, floor to ceiling, that woods wallpaper. I remember sitting in his room and playing some terrible Duck Hunter game because that was the only thing to do at his house.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Ugh, just like Gary Ridgway's gross, though, with it. So all of these dumping grounds were a special place for him to go and be alone with the women he murdered over and over again until there was nothing left, or until his site was discovered, at which point he would move on. As we know from his background, some of his earliest childhood fantasies were about necrophilia. We also know from a few survivors that Gary had major problems getting it up, which is probably because the women he was trying to be intimate with were still alive. Which is interesting that, like, survivors of his talk about that and that he gets mad.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I wonder if he couldn't, like, get hard with these sex workers. But then, like, his girlfriends that he had were like, we fucked all the time. Fucked like bunny rabbits. Like, he had sex 3 times a day with his girlfriends.
Yeah.
Like, what?
I think it comes back to that weird, like, attraction repulsion.
Right. Like, he doesn't want with sex workers specifically.
Well, I think he hates himself so much that it ends up not working out. That it's in his head.
Yeah.
And something weird's happening with, like, control.
Yeah.
And he wants to be in charge of that situation. Or he wants to be, I mean, we went back and forth on whether or not dominating was a good word for his mother. But yeah. I think maybe he wants to be, like, the underhand in that situation.
Oh.
And then it doesn't work out.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't even begin to pull that apart.
So our sixth victim is Giselle Lavorne. She was 17 when her boyfriend, Jake Baker, who's also known as Jack Back, which I hate.
I bet it's Jake Bake.
Jake Bake. Okay, that's better. He persuaded her to leave California with him. He was much older than her, and he was looking for a fresh start. He got a job driving a cab near the SeaTac Strip, and it didn't take much convincing because Giselle hated California. She'd just moved there from New Orleans a few years earlier. So she grew up her whole life in New Orleans and was basically in the middle of high school when her whole family uprooted to California. And she hated it. Hated California.
I mean, I see why.
Yeah.
Because you have to be mad about that when you're in high school. Well,
yeah, of course.
But also I'm like, ugh, Missouri. Who could be mad at California?
So she ran away a lot and ended up dropping out of high school when she was a junior. She honestly just kind of felt like she didn't fit in there. This was pretty heartbreaking to her parents because Giselle was extremely intelligent. Her IQ tested at genius level. Aside from reading as one of her favorite hobbies, she labeled herself as a deadhead. Just a groupie for the Grateful Dead, and she traveled America following their concerts. Her parents' hopes were that she would grow out of this phase. And, you know, once she did it for a bit, and then come back home. Sometimes Jack would go with her on her trips to watch the Grateful Dead, and sometimes she would travel alone. So she was in the Seattle area at this time because she wanted to pick up some things from Jack before heading back home to California. She had decided she would finish high school. What turned into just a few days of a visit lasted much longer due to Jack's persuasion. And by July of 1982, Giselle would be reported missing by Jack. She began sex work. What led her to the sex work industry is unsure. Most likely, she was young, traveling across the country, needed money, and had a very persuasive older boyfriend who also needed money. Key.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Gary Ridgway would eventually confess to her death, claiming his son Chad, who was 8 or 9 at the time, was with him when he picked Giselle up on July 17th, 1982. He left Chad alone in the truck while he and Giselle walked out of sight, where he claims they had quick sex, after which he choked her with his forearm as a plane flew overhead. To ensure she was dead after she was limp, he took off his socks, tied them together and around her neck, and then using a thick twig, he twisted the knot around and around until the twig broke. He left her body there just a few blocks away from where he picked her up, coming back after taking his son home to move Giselle's corpse to an apple orchard just south of the SeaTac airport, 2 to 3 miles from where he had picked her up. She was his first victim not dumped in the river. So Giselle was found on September 25th, 1982, by a biker who could smell her far before he actually discovered her, which he actually got off the bike to find the source of the smell.
Ugh.
Because it was that bad, and he probably assumed there's some large animal is honestly what he probably thought around here somewhere. I mean,
once you smell that level of decomposition, yeah. I don't think you forget it.
Looking for the source, he found Giselle's nude body half hidden in some brush. She had a pair of men's socks tightly tied around her neck. Giselle was positively ID'd through dental records due to the increased decomposition of her body. Though before the dental records were confirmed, detectives were confident it was her due to the bird tattoo on her right breast.
That is the detail that he brought his son with him. I mean, it's something that I think most people that know about this case are aware of.
Mm-hmm.
The balls.
Yeah.
That and your kid's not going to get out of the car.
Yeah.
Or tell.
Right. Like, what are you doing with this woman? Your kid's 8 or 9. He's not.
That's old enough to lie and to tell on you.
Yes. And to know what is actually going on.
I mean, 5 is old enough to be like, I know some shit went down today that I wasn't supposed to see.
Mm-hmm.
What if he'd, I just can't get over, like, what if he'd gotten out of the truck?
I don't know.
Well, I do know. I do know what would have happened. Gary Ridgway said later that he would have killed him.
His own son?
Yes. He said, I would have had to kill him. And he said it just like in the instance where they were talking about him stabbing the child. That he was far more concerned with himself getting away with it than what any idea of what happened to the kid. That's like all he could think about afterwards. And it was the same end game in this situation, that if his son had walked up to the scene and seen anything, it was like, okay, but it's me or you, and I don't want to get caught.
Oh, my God.
Everything was very, like, non-emotional, unless it was anger.
Yeah, yeah. Nope. And now, a word from our sponsor. Podcorn is a marketplace connecting podcasters to amazing podcast sponsorship opportunities, such as host-read ads, interview segments, topical discussions, and more. Their marketplace mission is to give podcasters like us transparency, creative freedom, and full control of how and when we monetize. There are so many opportunities for podcasters on Podcorn, and we have loved how easy it is to work within the platform. From getting registered and syncing our stats to uploading content and getting paid, the entire experience has been seamless. With Podcorn, there is no middleman. Podcasts of all sizes can browse and choose opportunities right on the platform, set their own rates, and collaborate with brands directly without any exclusivities. When you book a sponsorship, you get direct access to communicate with the team you're working with, and the best part is you get to choose your sponsor. Podcorn has dozens of potential sponsors you can send proposals to, ensuring that you endorse brands you believe in.
That's why we're here, talking to you about Podcorn.
You never give up any right to your podcast, and Podcorn is here to support you at every step and ensure you're protected and compensated for the work that you do for brands. We know other podcasters listen to our show. We can't recommend using Podcorn to find sponsorships enough. Get started today by clicking the link in our show notes to sign up. Start browsing sponsorship opportunities on Podcorn.
So we're on to the seventh victim found, Linda Rule. Linda Jane Rule, known as Janie to her family, was reported missing in October of 1982 after having last been seen on September 26th, 1982. She was last seen leaving her hotel room and was headed for the Northgate Mall. Janie had dropped out of school at a very young age and began drifting from home to home after leaving her own house at the age of 14. This change in room and homes wasn't new to her. She'd been doing it her whole life. When she was 3, her parents divorced, and her father took custody, only for him to remarry 3 more times in his life, and for her mom to end up fighting her dad for custody of her. She then moved in with an aunt and uncle while her parents were spending time in court, and at the age of 13, Janie moved in with her mom, but left shortly after when she saw her stepfather repeatedly hit her mother. She moved back in with her aunt and uncle for a time before finding a home in the sex work trade at the age of 14, going by the name of Ziggy. When her father found out about her lifestyle, he would drive to the area she worked and give money to her friends to pass along to her, feeling at a loss of what else to do, because at the time, she was an emancipated girl, meaning that the police couldn't get involved in forcing her to go home or to any type of youth center. Linda Rule was not originally part of the Green River victim list. She was only included after Gary Ridgway confessed to her murder. She was found near the Northgate Hospital on January 31st, 1983, by a man that was laying water pipes. Due to the location of her remains and where she went missing from, it was thought to be too far from where the Green River victims were going missing and being found. She was buried beneath some brush and branches and was just a skeleton with no soft tissue left to fully determine the cause of death, so she was identified by her dental records. Admitting to her murder, Ridgway gave detail that the killer would have known. He set fire to her hair, but put it out quickly due to fear of someone seeing or smelling it. Linda Jane Rule's funeral was held in February of 1983. Her family would later be present to read their victim impact statements at Ridgway's trial, but that wouldn't be for another 18 years.
On to victim number 8, who had been found. Carol Ann Christensen, who was 22. 22 and a single mother of a 5-year-old daughter when she went missing. Unlike most of Gary Ridgway's victims, Carol Ann was not a sex worker. She had just gotten a new job as a waitress at the Barn Door Tavern at 148th and the Pacific Highway. She lived near the highway where many of his victims had gone missing. And because she didn't have a car, she walked pretty much everywhere she needed to go. On May 3rd, 1983, just 2 days after starting her new job, she didn't come home. Her mom was watching her daughter and immediately knew something was wrong when Carol didn't show up after her shift was over. Carol Ann was responsible, loved her daughter, and was excited to have a job to support the pair. She would have called her mom if something had held her up at work or if she had met with someone after work, like if she went to get drinks or whatever. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be long before Carolyn's family had their heartbreaking answer. Just 5 days after her mother reported her missing, she was found on May 8th, 1983, in an area called Maple Valley, about 20 miles from the airport. A family who was mushroom hunting in the woods found the fully clothed body of Carol Ann. She was on her back with a paper bag covering her head. Her hands were resting on her stomach and covered with ground sausage. That wasn't the only strange thing at the scene of her death. Two dead fish that were completely gutted lay across her throat. An entire empty bottle of wine lay across her lower stomach. Her cause of death would later be determined to be strangulation, just like the other victims. The yellow braided plastic rope used to kill her was still at the crime scene. She was another victim not initially investigated by the Green River Task Force. Once the task force realized she lived and worked in the designated kill zone, she was added as Green River victim number 8, the only victim with that staged of a crime scene. So Ridgway would later confess to her murder, stating he knew her and she had been nice to him. Obviously, he's a deranged individual and not someone who's we should trust. So I'm going to make a few assumptions about what happened based on his version of events. I think Ridgway probably saw her walking to work, and he frequented a singles bar near her work. Maybe this led him to stopping in to get some dinner, finding out what time she got off work, which led him to offering her a ride home since she didn't have a car. Instead, he took her back to his house, raped her, and when she asked, begged, pleaded to be taken home, he got mad and choked her to death. He claims he redressed her as he drank an entire bottle of wine. She would only be the second victim to be redressed, adding that when he left the house to dump her body, he took the fish someone else had given him along with the sausage because he didn't cook, and he thought they could be used to attract animals to her corpse. He also quoted to the police, "I laid her face up, put the grocery bag over her head, and laid down with her. I cried because I killed her."
This reminded me so much of the case of Robert Spahalski.
Yeah.
Where he is like in a drug rage and kills his friend and then realizes what he's done and hides her and just lays by her and cries. I think that, I don't know. I'm very conflicted just because I don't think that he did any of those things for reasons that he said.
Yeah.
But I kind of believe if he was willing to admit that he was that upset, that he might have been. But I don't know that I believe anything about how they met.
No.
I think his version of them meeting was that he knew who she was.
Yeah, his version is that he knew her and that she went home with him willingly and they had consensual sex. That is his version. And then he kills her. Like, because she wants to go home. So it's like, no, that's not what happened. I don't think she went home with you willingly. I think you offered to take her home, and then you took her to your home. And then when she didn't offer it up to you, you raped her, and then you killed her.
Yeah, I think there are any number of situations where he is firmly an aggressor.
Yeah.
Because you just have to look at the statistics of how many women did he have consensual sex with that he murdered versus the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
He did not, any women that he knew and had a relationship with in any sense, as far as being like a girlfriend or, you know, whatever the level of that is, like
right.
a fiance, right. a girlfriend, someone he met at the parent group, mm-hmm. he didn't do that to them.
No. And this is like in the midst of, I mean, she was victim number 8. So at this point, he has killed 7 people and gotten away with it and has built up this like aggression and violence. And yeah, maybe if he had actually met her out, they maybe would have formed an actual romantic relationship, you know? But it was like this intermingling of like his two lives where he's dating these women, having consensual sex, and then he's also murdering sex workers.
Yeah. The crossover, if any, is there.
Yeah.
It seems
like maybe he expected him like to get his way with her because he does with the sex workers he kills, which is what he's been now doing for 7 people. And then that's not how it happens. And then he crosses those paths of like, well, this is someone I actually would have dated.
Well, right.
And then maybe I killed her.
If they did meet. Yeah. And that part's true. And she didn't fit this cookie cutter mold of, I need you to be my mother.
Yeah.
That it was just over right then.
Yeah.
Victim 9 that was found was Shonda Leah Summers, who was 16 years old. In October of 1982, Shonda Summers' family reported her missing, and they would spend the next 10 months searching for her. On August 11th, 1983, a couple who went apple picking found the second body that would be discovered in the apple orchard near the SeaTac airport. There were 3 empty houses on the property when the couple stumbled across bones scattered around, some partially covered by brush and trash. It would take dental records once again to identify this victim, and it was then discovered to be 16-year-old Shonda Summers. Her cause of death remains unknown due to the partial skeletal remains being all that was found. When her body was discovered, many families with missing daughters waited in anticipation for a confirmation on her identity. There were many families who wanted closure, and Shonda's family finally got a bit of that. Unfortunately, this is all the information we have on Shonda Summers. Victim 10 is simply known as Bones, unknown. Just 2 days after Shonda's remains were found on August 13th, 1983, another set of human remains was found nearby, buried in a shallow grave. It was just unknown bones.
So we're pretty much at a point now that this is, I mean, people are afraid. Everyone knows about it. Because I think it's not just sex workers, it's young girls. Like, it's teenagers who are runaways. It's people who are hitchhikers. It's women who are walking home from work. You know, like, it's now getting to a point that it's like, yeah, most of them were sex workers, even the teenagers, but there's still like this, he's after everyone. He's after our children. He's after right. the women. Like, but people were afraid, like, now. And it was just, I think, chaos town, honestly, in Washington and in and around, like, Seattle and all these areas that this was happening.
Yeah, reading the book, you really get a good sense from Ann Rule's writing of, like, how pent up and frightened people were, especially mm-hmm. girls and women that were working the SeaTac Strip and the measures that they took to protect each other, mm-hmm. saying, like, okay, I'm going to follow you. Following someone, saying, okay, good. I'm going to wait in a car, and when this guy picks you up for mm-hmm. a date, I'll just tail him and sit behind him until he drops you back off.
Yes.
Even with measures like that, though, there's no stopping him.
No. So we move on to victim number 11, who was initially identified as Bones number 2. Gail Matthews had hit a rough spot in her life in February of 1983. She had no job, was recently divorced, she had lost custody of her daughter, and was kicked out of her apartment because she couldn't afford rent. Misery loves company, and her boyfriend of almost a year, Kurt, fed into that same misery. Kurt was actually a very smart guy. He's super well-educated, but he liked drinking, drugs, and gambling too much to maintain a steady job. He and Gail fit well together, both trying to figure it out. He was a bit older, 34 to her 24, but both enjoyed each other's company. They would frequent bars such as Midway Tavern, VIP Tavern, White Shutters, and Trudy's, all located in or around the Pacific Highway. Usually, Kurt would try to get involved in a poker game to make enough money to buy them dinner and pay for a hotel room. Sometimes Gail would come up with the money, and no questions were asked on how she got it. But Kurt was not stupid, so he probably knew. April 27th, 1983 was the last night Kurt saw Gail. They had been drinking at the VIP tavern when Kurt decided he would head over to the Midway tavern to see if there were any poker games he could get involved in. Gail told him she was going to try to find a way to keep their hotel room for another few nights. He left to catch a bus to the Midway tavern, which was about a mile away. And while waiting at the bus stop, he noticed a green or blue Ford pickup truck. The only reason he noticed the truck was because it had numerous gray spots, basically primer spots, as if it was about to be painted. They stood out on the dark paint of the car. As he looked, he noticed a passenger in the car and was taken aback when he realized it was Gail. He began to wave when he realized something appeared off. In that quick glance, he realized she looked dazed, just staring straight ahead. He's quoted to the police saying, "She was looking right at me, but it was as if she didn't see me. I'm sure she could see me. It wasn't dark out yet." At this strange behavior, he began to wave harder to get her attention, anything to have her confirm to him that she was all right. She still didn't seem to notice, and Kurt watched helplessly as the truck turned left. "I don't know how to explain it," he's quoted saying, "but I felt fear. Fear for her because I sensed she was in danger." He later told police he ran across the road in an attempt to catch the truck before it turned left, but didn't make it. He decided he was overreacting and got on the bus to Midway. No one wanted to play poker there. He only stayed for an hour before heading back to their hotel room, waiting outside to watch the cars go by, waiting for Gail to come back, but she never did. He called that evening to report Gail as a missing persons, but was told he couldn't make a report that early because he wasn't related to her.
That's stupid.
Yeah.
So I can't even fathom how that's a thing. Even then, I'm not even going to say like, it was the 80s. Like no.
He's been her boyfriend of a year. They've lived together, like, in an unconventional way, but still, like,
what does someone have to do?
He's been the one person around her for the last year. How can he not report her missing?
No. Well, like, what does someone have to do to be credible?
I don't know. Yeah, could he have called back and said, "This is her father. She's missing"?
Right.
Like, yeah, I don't
know. You don't know that over a phone call anyway.
Right. So Kurt spent the next few days walking to all the places they went together, questioning people if they had seen her. No one had. He eventually moved on, a little heartbroken, but drugs and alcohol were his solace. Gail's body was discovered on September 18th, 1983, but she would not be identified until February of 1985. Gail would be the first body discovered at Gary's third dumping site, and by far his favorite. More than six victims would later be discovered here, at Star Lake. It was about 10 miles south of the Strip, and at the bottom of the hill, driving down a winding road, there's a road called Star Lake Road, heavily wooded at the time. She was found very close to the road, near essentially a huge drop-off. So what they describe is like it's a ravine, mm-hmm. and it's like there is a road that's winding, but it's all just forest, and then there's a very short amount of area before there's a drop-off. And she was found next to the road. And it's kind of questioned how she was not found sooner, because she was skeletal remains by the time she was found. And I mean, she's right off the side of the road, literally right off the road, like right there.
Ugh.
Yeah, and all the other victims they eventually find there will be found farther into, like, much farther into the ravine area. Mm-mm-mm. So Kurt would be in prison in Texas for drug-related offenses by the time the FBI made their way back to him to tell him Gail had been found. He agreed to be hypnotized to try to help in any way he could about remembering what happened the night he last saw her, but nothing new came from this technique. Gail, along with many other skulls that were discovered, would be identified with the help of Betty Pat Gatliff, a forensic sculptor in Oklahoma, whose technique included placing erasers around the face because the thickness was similar to actual human tissue and muscle. She would then add clay to create flesh and smooth it around. This would end up creating somewhat of a distinguishable face. She would add a wig and eyebrows, sometimes glasses, to help the victim become identified. Sometimes her creations and the skull would be passed off to forensic artist Frank Bender, who would talk to the skulls to get their story, which helped him get a sense of what they would look like in life. And so that's how Gail was found.
I think I've seen that particular picture of, like, the recreation.
Yeah.
That was done of that. What does he mean by talk to the skulls?
He would literally, like, talk to them. Like, have conversations with them. That's what
How
it sounded
that help
like.
Him draw them or sculpt them.
A little, I don't know, a little off.
Okay. Whatever you say, Frank.
So when medical examiners released information about Gail's bones, who was labeled as bones number 2 at the time, her pelvis looked as if it had been fractured and her arm was dislocated, which both could have happened during her fight with the killer. You know, they mm-hmm. have no idea of knowing. But it was worth a shot to put that information out to the media to help identify her. Gail's sister-in-law heard this news and remembered that Gail had broke her pelvis in a boating accident in 1980. And it was this point, like I said, in February of 1985, that Bones number 2 was finally identified.
How random and lucky that she was watching or saw wherever she did that was a call out being released.
I know.
Just 8 days after Gail was last seen entering a truck with an average man wearing plaid, Marie Valvar's last sighting would be extremely similar. Marie was 18 years old and grew up in a large Filipino family. Marie's boyfriend, better known as Pimp, in Olivia's personal opinion, always watched what cars she got into and made a note of the make, model, license plate, and a driver description if he could. Sometimes he would even follow the cars, and he would always wait up for her to come home. On the evening of April 30th, 1983, Richie was doing just that as a dark Ford truck pulled up. He made a note that there were primer paint spots on the car, specifically the passenger door. In this particular instance, Richie decided to follow the truck, and he pulled up alongside it to make sure Marie was comfortable, and to him, she looked upset and like she might want to get out of the vehicle. It was at that moment that the truck sped up and made a U-turn and headed south. Richie followed but got stopped at a red light. He claims to have seen the truck make a left, trailing just a minute behind, but when he turned left, he saw no truck, no headlights, nothing. Driving around for a bit with no luck, he decided to go back to the hotel parking lot and wait, but the man in the truck never returned, and neither did Marie. 4 days passed before Richie went to the police to report Marie missing, and he failed to mention the circumstances surrounding her disappearance, most likely because of the fear of the trouble that he would get into for being involved in sex work with her. As I said earlier, Marie was from a large Filipino family who loved her very much. Her mother and father cared greatly about her, as did her 4 brothers and 1 sister. In early May, when her father still hadn't heard from her for a few days, he picked up Richie and asked him to ride along and show him exactly where he lost sight of the truck. It was daylight this time, and they were able to spot a small road sign that Richie had previously missed, and they turned down south to 20th Place, and they found a cul-de-sac. In the driveway of one of the homes was an old pickup truck with a primer spot on the passenger side door. The police were called, but they felt the man was straightforward with his answers and there wasn't any probable cause to search his premises. She was likely not there, but if her disappearance had been taken more seriously, the killer may have been found a lot sooner. Weeks later, Marie Malvar's driver's license was discovered at the SeaTac airport. When Gary Ridgway was finally being looked at as a potential suspect, it was discovered he lived in the home where Marie's family and boyfriend had led police. Marie's family would gather every April 1st to celebrate her birthday and pray that she would be returned safely, until, essentially, they all grew apart. They would wait 20 years before she would be found, and by then, she was only bones dumped near Auburn. Gary Ridgway would later confess to her murder and state that she injured him, scratching him so badly on his arm he poured acid over it to hide the scar. Because of this, he dumped her body far away from all the others. She was alone, because he had gotten so mad at her for fighting back. He also claimed that he tried to find her, but couldn't remember the exact spot because he was so angry when he dumped her.
Which I think is, I don't know. I don't think I believe him.
I mean, yeah, I feel like we say that all the time. Like, you just can't.
No.
Like, why would I believe anything you say?
Well, if you remember so much that you were so worried about disguising the disfigurement that she left on your arm with acid, I think you remember everything else about it because it's an abnormal situation for you. Yeah. You did not get to completely overpower her immediately. Yeah. You had an obstacle to deal with, and that makes the situation stick out in your mind.
Right. And, yeah, you would remember where you, yeah. Just the fact that he went back, he claims he went back to find her. You found her.
Yeah. I know. I mean, yeah, he might not have known years later when the police took him
right, on exactly
all those fucking field trips, but.
Yeah. Yeah. Whew. Okay, you guys, we are getting through this. Victim number 13, Yvonne Shelley Antosh, was 19. She was originally from Vancouver when she made her way down to Seattle, Washington. Staying with a friend in a hotel room on the Strip, she was last seen on May 3rd, 1983. May 30th, 1983, near South 141st.
South 141st. Oh, God.
South 141st Street.
We've said all the street numbers like completely wrong. You're supposed to say it out like 220th Street.
Oh, I've been saying like 126. 141st. What was I trying to say there? 141st Street. Her friend hadn't heard from her for months when police came to ask questions. Yvonne was discovered on October 15th, 1983, near Black Diamond Road, and she was just skeletal remains by then. And again, this is just all the information we have on her.
That yeah. breaks my heart.
I know.
That even her friends.
Her friend didn't even say anything. Literally, the police came to her once they found her. And that's... found out that she had been staying in this hotel with this other girl.
Awful.
Victim number 14 that had been found, Constance Known, was 19, mostly living in her Camaro and working at a sausage factory. She was trying to get ahead in life, but her drug addiction forced her to fall back a lot. She was homeless, so she wasn't paying rent, but she was also making minimum wage, which wasn't going to cut it if she was going to continue her drug habit. She began sex work and would often park her Camaro at the Red Lion on 188th Street when she was walking the strip. The last she was heard of was on June 8th, 1983, when she picked up her paycheck. She called her boyfriend to tell him she was on her way over to visit him, but she never made it. Her car was discovered at the Red Lion in late June. It had clearly not been moved for a while, with pretty much zero clues left behind. Constance's body wasn't discovered until October 27th, 1983, near the SeaTac Airport. She had been found near large-leafed maple trees on empty land behind Alaska Airlines headquarters, very close to where Yvonne Antosh was discovered. Two more bodies would soon be discovered at this site, which we called the south of the SeaTac Airport site.
What was that? Oh, that site.
That site, yeah. So she was found by Yvonne, which I don't have under there, but she was found near her. Victim number 15, we don't have, I mean, barely any information on, Kelly Ware. She was 22 when she disappeared on July 18th, 1983, just 10 days after Constance was last seen. She was last seen on Madison Street in central Seattle, and she was found just 2 days after Constance on October 29th, 1983. Well, we have now made it through Gary Ridgway's first 15 victims that were found.
Yeah, discovered. Again, we're going in order of discovery, and we'll have a couple different tools hopefully available by this point to post and help you understand the timeline of who is being reported missing when and who is being found when.
Yes.
And all of that information is going to be vital later in tying all of these women back to Gary Ridgway.
Yes.
He's just so fucking nondescript.
I know.
Time and time again, mm-hmm. he is, like, just called a chameleon. And, like, yeah. he's so normal.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to pin anything on him because he just adapts.
And I don't think he's someone that gives people this creepy vibe necessarily, you know? Not in any more ways than what especially those sex workers were dealing with, you know?
Yeah, that's probably very true.
He probably wasn't any more creepy than anyone else out there.
My radar would be...
Your radar would be higher.
Yeah. I would not have any tolerance for that.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually... This is a good place for a quote that I found from Mark Prothero, who wrote, "Defending Gary, Unraveling the Mind of the Green River Killer," which we might be referencing in later episodes as we get into the trial. He says he remembers that Gary's forte had always been his adaptability, his capacity to be whatever people expected of him. Despite his lack of education, despite his below-average intelligence, Gary was, I think, the finest method actor alive. It wasn't conscious so much as it was instinctual. He could cry when he wanted to and shut it off just as abruptly. If you wanted remorse, he could do that. If you wanted him mad, sad, stupid, smart, embarrassed, boastful, sinful, or religious, he could do them all, and you'd be convinced.
Insane. Complete chameleon, like you said.
Well, yeah, and then coupling that with the idea that he was reading true crime books and magazines to try to mirror behavior.
Mm-hmm. Or to do the opposite when someone got caught
right.
and behaved a particular way that made people feel uncomfortable.
Very telling. But I don't know. Maybe that's why he didn't get caught for so long, because maybe. He thought so simply.
Yeah, maybe.
And just decided, I have to attach myself to whatever works in this situation.
Maybe. We've done a lot of talking tonight.
Yes. So we will pick back up next time in episode 3 of this series, yes. Continuing the chain of victims that are found and getting into the investigation as police start to uncover suspects and what's going on with the timeline and how they start to piece things together. In other news, Nancy Pelosi, in the midst of this recording.
Oh, yeah.
We're quite a bit ahead on this one. Tonight was the State of the Union. And this yes. woman, blessed she be, stood up after that piece of shit was over and ripped it in half.
Ripped it in half.
Okay, I want you to. I know you have it on the microphone. Cut in the gasp that I made when you showed me the video.
Okay. Okay.
And here it is now. True reaction to this moment.
Also.
Oh my god.
Breaking news, everyone.
Rips it in half.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think I see a hint of pride in Melania's face. Okay, fucking Sorry. Mike Pence is trying not to laugh.
Oh, he is. Yeah, very hard. Very hard. Because did you see that Trump didn't shake her hand at the start? Did you see that?
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. Like, he hands Pence a folder, and then he hands hers her folder, and then she goes out to, like, stick her hand out, shake his hand, and he just fully turns away.
Fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's a fucking icon.
I know.
Wonderful. Beautiful. I'm in awe.
Just, oh my gosh. She didn't like wait for anything.
Right
she
on camera.
Immediately stood up, ripped that shit in half, and like tossed it aside.
And I know, like, well, we did get a comment recently that we're too political. And oh, I mean, yeah. I feel like someone said that because you just don't want that muddying up your true crime podcast, which is fine.
Yeah.
But. And I know that Nancy Pelosi is, like, not an angel. She's problematic sometimes.
Very.
Everyone is. Very. Everyone is.
But that was just a great moment.
It must live on forever.
Yes.
Her tiny little clap and now this. I'm just like, yes. She's fucking had it.
Yeah.
And she's had, like,
clearly.
The year of her life.
Yeah.
Put her on a candle and let me light it at the altar of satanic femininity.
Yes. Please.
All hail Nancy Pelosi.
And satanic femininity.
Two things I'm very comfortable with.
Yeah.
All right.
We'll see you guys next week.
Yes. As always, you can find us on all of the social media at Death by Champagne, Dead from Shamps, deathbyshamps@gmail.com. Hang out with us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook page. If you enjoy what we're doing with the show and want to support us and get some extra content, we do extra episodes every month for certain tiers of patrons. You can get that bonus content and get all of your regular episodes a day early on Thursdays.
Yes.
Hang out with us, patreon.com/deathbyshampagne. And until next time,
we're here to keep you up at night.
Hail Nancy fucking Pelosi.
And pop some bottles.
Not bad. Not bad for a can.
Bye.
Goodbye.